This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. The trained assassin Jason Bourne has returned to the screen in The Bourne Supremacy, based on the spy novel by Robert Ludlum. It's the sequel to the 2002 espionage thriller, The Bourne Identity. Bourne is played by Matt Damon, one of the most popular actors of his generation. He starred in such films as Saving Private Ryan, The Talented Mr. Ripley, and Good Will Hunting, for which he also won an Oscar for the screenplay he wrote with his longtime friend, Ben Affleck. Terry Gross spoke with Matt Damon in 2002, when the first Bourne film was in theaters. In that film, Jason Bourne is adrift in the Mediterranean Sea, where he's rescued by fishermen. He has amnesia and has no recollection of what happened to him or who he is. The only clues are a couple of bullets in his back and a Swiss bank account number surgically implanted in his hip. He goes to the Swiss bank and finds his safe deposit box, which contains lots of cash, a gun, and several passports with his photo, but different names. In this scene, he's talking to a woman, played by Franca Potente, who's helping him find his way.
Who has a safety deposit box full of money and six passports and a gun? Who has a bank account number in their hip?
I come in here, and the first thing I'm doing is I'm catching the sight lines and looking for an exit.
I see the exit sign, too. I'm not worried. I mean, you were shot. People do all kinds of weird and amazing stuff when they're scared.
I can tell you the license plate numbers of all six cars outside. I can tell you that our waitress is left-handed and the guy sitting up at the counter weighs 215 pounds and knows how to handle himself. I know the best place to look for a gun is the cab of the gray truck outside. And at this altitude, I can run flat out for a half mile before my hands start shaking. Now, why would I know that?
Damon trained in boxing and martial arts in preparation for his role as the buff and agile killer. But for an earlier role, he took a different approach.
You know, I read that for Courage Under Fire, when you had to lose weight, you not only starved yourself, but you used laxatives. Now, that can't be very healthy.
Actually, laxatives I used after I started eating again, because I did it unsupervised. And so all I was doing was I would run 13 miles every day, and I would eat chicken and egg whites and vegetables and 1 to 2 baked potatoes every day. For my carbohydrates. But I would run 6.5 miles in the morning and then 6.5 at night. And by the end of it, when my body really started kind of eating itself, like eventually your muscle just starts, you're consuming muscle at the end. There's no fat left really to consume. And I was just so tired. I just remember I would wake up in the morning, I would sit up in my bed. We were in Austin, Texas shooting, and I would immediately fall back over because I would get faint. So that was how I was working out at the end. I mean, it was stupid, and it was unsupervised, and I was low down on the totem pole. The studio wasn't going to spend, you know, $1,500 for me to have a trainer. I mean, but I also knew that it was a chance for me to get more work if I played the role. If I was honest and true in the role, then somebody would take notice. Anybody, you know.
Did Robert De Niro create this thing where, like, after Raging Bull, you had to put on weight or take off weight or physically change in some amazing way?
I'm sure he. I mean, I grew up, you know, with that, seeing Raging Bull and loving that performance in that movie. And, you know, and I was 25 when I did Courage Under Fire, and it was, you know, the young man's kind of swagger and saying, look, you know, this is what I'm willing to do. This is what I'll put my body through. This is what, because the people that you really, you know, idolize did it too. And it's also this kind of weird, you know, living out in Los Angeles and not being able to get acting work, you know, it's a weird way of saying, you know, no matter what happens, nobody's ever going to tell me that there's anybody out here with more discipline or who will give up more for, you know, will sacrifice more for their job than me. And I don't
know.
So
what'd you get for it?
What's that?
What'd you get for it, for all the sacrifice?
Sick. I got sick. And, you know, eventually when I went back to Boston, yeah, the doctor put me on 2 different kinds of medication, and he said I'd really done some bad things to my body. He checked me out, and the first thing he said was, the only good thing I can tell you is that your heart didn't shrink.
Jeez.
And then he told
That's
me I could
option?
Never do it again.
Wow.
Yeah, well, it's your heart's a muscle, so if I'd kept up with it, you know, obviously that's what happens to people with anorexia, and, you know, eventually their bodies just shut down. so, but what my, you know, my big master plan of having people take notice, the movie came out and I was on this medication and the reviews for Courage Under Fire came out and none of them mentioned me at all. And that was when I just said, you know what, this is ridiculous, you know. But it was heartbreaking for me. It was really heartbreaking.
Now, you met Ben Affleck when you were about 10. Did he want to act, too? I mean, was the desire to act part of the basis of your friendship?
Definitely. Well, he was acting. He was known in Cambridge as the professional actor because he was on this PBS series called The Voyage of the Mimi, which was an educational TV show that was on PBS, and they use it as a tool in schools. And we lived two blocks from each other, but we really became friends in high school when he got to high school. So I was 15 or 16 when he got there, and he was 14. And then we fashioned, a very, very deep bond, and a lot of it was based on what we both wanted to do. I mean, it's a weird thing looking back and going and meeting 16-year-olds or meeting 14-year-olds. He and I were flying to New York together at that age. Because my parents didn't support the idea that I would do this professionally at that age. They didn't say that I couldn't do it. They never did things like that. But they said they wouldn't pay for me to go to New York to audition for things. And so I did a local commercial in Boston. Ben and I went and got cast in a local commercial in Boston.
Wait, I'm going to interject. I think it was a TJ Maxx commercial.
Yeah, it was.
Get the Max for the minimum.
Minimum at TJ Maxx. And we got cut out of the commercial, but we still got paid.
Did you have to sing or try on coats or
no,
what?
No, I forget. I think we were sitting at a cafeteria table and a pretty girl walked by and we had to look at her and then look at each other like, isn't it great to be back in school or something? Like, it was like a back-to-school ad.
Oh.
But we opened up a bank account and put the money in and we called it like, you know, our business bank account. But the money was four trips to New York for, you know, on the old Pan Am shuttle or on the train.
You ended up going to Harvard.
Mm-hmm.
You grew up in Cambridge, so that wasn't far to go.
Right.
Far to go intellectually, but not geographically.
Right.
And then you left, I think, during or before your senior year?
Yeah.
To work?
Yeah, I left a few times. I left in the second semester of my sophomore year to do a TNT movie. And then I came back and then left to do School Ties. And then came back again, and then left to do a movie called Geronimo.
I'm one of the few people who saw that.
Oh, you're the one. Yeah. Which was a great
experience.
Walter Hill. Yeah. And that was a great experience. I mean, I got to work with Duvall and Gene Hackman. I didn't really get to work with Gene Hackman, but I shook his hand and I said. He said, "What's your name?" And I said, "Matt Damon." He said, "Mark, great to meet you."
Matt Damon speaking with Terry Gross. He plays the trained assassin Jason Bourne in the new film, The Bourne Supremacy. We'll continue after this break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with Matt Damon. In 1998, Damon and his longtime friend Ben Affleck won an Oscar for their screenplay for Good Will Hunting. Damon was nominated for an Oscar for his performance in the film as Will, a young man from South Boston who works as a janitor at Harvard, but is able to solve seemingly unsolvable math problems left on a blackboard. Will grew up in foster homes and has a rap sheet. When he's jailed for instigating a fight, a professor who sees Will's genius bails him out on the condition that he gets some counseling. Will's psychologist is played by Robin Williams. In this scene, Will is in the psychologist's office when a painting catches his eye, a painting made by the psychologist.
The linear and impressionistic mix makes a very muddled composition. It's also a Winslow Homer ripoff, except you got Whitey rowing the boat there.
Well, it's an odd one, eh? It wasn't very good.
That's not really what concerns me, though.
What concerns you?
It's the coloring.
You know what the real bitch of it is? It's paint by number.
Is it color by number? Because the colors are fascinating to me.
Are they really? What about that?
I think you're about one step away from cutting your f***ing ear off.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
I think I should move to the south of France, change my name to Vincent.
You ever heard the saying, any port in a storm?
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe that means you.
In what way?
Maybe you're in the middle of a storm, a big f***ing storm.
Yeah.
The sky's falling on your head, the waves are crashing over your little boat, the oars are about to snap. You're just pissing your pants, you're crying for the harbor, so maybe you do what you gotta do to get out. You know, maybe you became a psychologist.
Bingo. That's it. Let me do my job now. You start with me. Come on.
Maybe you married the wrong woman.
Maybe you should watch your mouth.
Watch it right there, Chief, all right?
Well, that's it, isn't it? You married the wrong woman? What happened? Why'd she leave you? Was she, you know, banging some other guy?
If you ever disrespect my wife again, I will end you. I will f***ing end you.
Let's get to Good Will Hunting. The movie, I think, is based on a play that you wrote when you were still a student at Harvard. What was the original play like?
I wrote it, actually. It was a playwriting course that this guy, Anthony Kubiak, taught at Harvard, which is a terrific course. And I wrote it as a screenplay, you know, in screenplay format. And the original one was 41 pages long, and it just had the beginnings of a story, and it had, from what survived of it was the one scene that survived from that was the first time that I meet Robin Williams' character in that movie, when he eventually grabs me by the neck and throws me up against the wall because I say something about his wife. And that scene was verbatim as I wrote in Anthony Kubiak's class. But nothing else, nothing else survived. But he encouraged me, the teacher encouraged me when I finished the class. He gave me an A, and it was the first, you know, one of the first times I got an A at Harvard. And I didn't care what I got in the class. I had such a good time in the class, and he gave me an A, and next to it, he wrote on the paper, he wrote, you know, you should really keep going with this. This really seems like it could be leading somewhere. And encouraged me to do it. And so a few months later, for spring break, I went to Los Angeles to audition, actually for Geronimo, an American legend, and stayed with Ben and brought the, you know, work in progress thing with me and showed him, and he loved it. And he said, this is great. We should do something with this. And so we agreed, you know, neither of us knew which way to go with it, though. So a little later on, I did Geronimo and then moved in. Ben and I got a place in L.A. with Casey, his brother, and we were there for like a year before, you know, and this thing was just sitting on the shelf because neither of us could think of what to do. And then one night we were literally sitting around talking. It was probably 1 a.m, and it just started. I think Ben was the first one. He started saying something, and the way that things normally work with us is one person says a little thing, the next person, and it just starts to rapidly, which is why, you know, we're utterly useless without each other. At least we have been so far. But it happened really, and it kind of tumbled out, and the script came really, really quickly.
I want to ask you about the talented Mr. Ripley. You were really just terrific in that film. And you're playing somebody who doesn't have any of the things he wants. Friends, a lover, interesting work, interesting life, travel, money,
right.
None of that. And through a little bit of deception, or perhaps a lot of deception, he's able to kind of change his life and become part of this, like, charmed circle of wealthy people.
Right.
Revolving particularly around this one couple played by Jude Law and
right.
Gwyneth Paltrow. And the first time you meet them, you're meeting them, is it in Italy?
Yeah.
And you're on the Mediterranean on a beach, and they're all, like, bronzed and beautiful, and you've just arrived from
New York City.
Yeah, and you're pale and kind of scrawny. This is one of the
right.
roles you lost weight for. And the first time you meet them, you're in your bathing suit, and you just look so wrong.
Right.
You look so out of place. And it sets the tone beautifully for everything that's to follow, this physically uncomfortable, out of the place, wrong-looking person. Can you talk a little bit just about that scene even?
Yeah, it was just right. I mean, it was right there in the script when I read it, and it made total sense. And we wanted, obviously, when Ripley starts to try to take over Dickie's identity, for him to try to look more and more like him. So the bigger gap you can leave at the beginning, the better that's going to come across. And also, we just love the awkwardness of it. You know, the green bathing suit that I wore was, you know, maybe a little bit kind of over the top. There was a scene, though, that Anthony had. Anthony Minghella scripted, just in case he felt we needed it, where they show me buying the bathing suit. I see him on the beach, and so I buy the bathing suit, and that's the only one they have, which is how I ended up with that bathing suit, just in case it seemed too kind of goofy that I would have a lime green, you know, bathing suit. But, you know, Anthony looked at the movie and didn't feel like we needed it, and so there's Ripley kind of showing up as pale. I mean, they painted me alabaster for that.
Oh, really?
Yeah, oh, yeah.
You got painted pale.
Yeah, and I already was pale. I had stayed out of the sun for, you know, months and months, and I was as pale as I could be, but they you know, even put more kind of gook all over me.
What did you do internally to get into the character of somebody who wants so desperately to live this life that he has no access to, that he finally ends up not only deceiving but killing for it?
It's just that I can really relate. I really related to that character in a lot of ways. I really related to that.
In what way?
I don't know. I've had that feeling, you know, in my life of wanting to belong somewhere and not belonging, and especially kind of in, you know, adolescence and teenage years. I mean, those are you feel that with such pain, and you know.
Yeah, but you already had an agent in New York.
Yeah, right. That's
you
right.
You brag about to your friends.
Yeah, God. I mean, there was a lot to him that to that character that I just really related to and loved, I still feel bad for that character. I got really mad the first time I saw the movie, actually, with the final music, because there was a scene where I'm walking at Gwyneth and I have a razor in my pocket. And the music that, you know, which it's perfect for the movie. It's right for the movie. But because Anthony was my kind of, you know, partner in crime, that the whole time we were shooting it, every time something, you know, we would ask something, you know, we'd say, well, should Ripley, I mean, I'd say, so I'm going to kill Freddy with this statue? And he'd go, of course you're going to kill Freddy. Freddy's coming into your house. Freddy is accusing you of doing it. How dare he? He has a lot of nerve. You know, he was very much my ally, you know, when we were shooting it, because that was what got me ready for every scene was the fact that what I'm doing makes total sense. This is, of course I'm going to do this, and this makes, you know. So Anthony was a very good kind of sounding board for the Ripley rationale. But of course, at the end of the day, he's the director of the movie. So when he goes to put the music over the scene where I'm walking towards Gwyneth with a razor blade, he's not defending Ripley. He's got this kind of Hitchcockian music over it. And so when I saw it, I was like, you know, how, you know.
He told me I was justified.
Yeah, exactly. How dare you? You're supposed to be my friend.
What was it like for you when you first became, when you first started acting in movies with big stars in it, and then you became a big star yourself, and suddenly all the people who you admired when you were young, who seemed so out of reach, who lived either in the television box or on the big screen, were colleagues of yours or friends of yours or people you had access to. Was it awkward at first to be in that circle, to be in that situation where people who were always just these like movie figures were now actually three-dimensional people, and you were working with them or you were talking with them?
Yeah, that was weird. I mean, the only time I really run into other people, you know, that I've grown up watching or whatever, is at like a ceremony or, you know, an event or something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I haven't really run into too many people, although I have an assistant, and I guess, you know, for two years ago for Christmas, I guess I have a habit of talking about Morgan Freeman a lot because I really respect Morgan
Freeman. Oh, he's
great,
yeah.
And this is going to sound really silly, but for Christmas a couple of years ago, she gave me as a Christmas gift dinner with Morgan Freeman. She called Morgan Freeman's assistant, and I guess he thought it was funny, and so they kind of agreed, and it was like a, you know, make-a-wish dinner or something where I was like Chris Farley on the old Chris Farley show on Saturday Night Live. Like, remember that time in that movie when you did that thing? That was awesome. But for the most part, the most I get to know people is working with them. And I've been incredibly lucky to starting with back with Duvall and how good he was to me and how and he didn't have to do that, and the guy is a living legend, you know, and he tolerated my questions, and I did Courage Under Fire with Denzel Washington, and he was really nice to me, and Rainmaker. I mean, God damn, Danny DeVito, Mickey Rourke was great to me. Mickey Rourke sat me down the first time I met him, kind of forcefully, and said, "Don't screw this up. Don't do what I did. I was a jerk to people. He said, you appreciate what you have and be polite to everybody you meet and don't ever screw this up. It was pretty, you know, affecting.
Matt Damon, thank you so much.
All right, thanks for having me.
Matt Damon speaking with Terry Gross in 2002. He stars as the trained assassin Jason Bourne in the new film The Bourne Supremacy, based on the thriller by Robert Ludlum. We'll hear what our film critic David Edelstein thinks about the film later in today's show. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies.
Forget it, Jake. It's Chinatown.
The tragedy and the romance which filled the screen in Chinatown wouldn't have been the same without the lush, dark score by Jerry Goldsmith.
All right, come on, clear the area! On the sidewalk! On the sidewalk! Get off the street!
Composer Jerry Goldsmith died on Wednesday at his home in Beverly Hills. He was 75. Goldsmith was one of the most prolific composers for film and television. His film scores included Chinatown, Patton, Star Trek, Alien, The Sand Pebbles, A Patch of Blue, the original Planet of the Apes, and L.A. Confidential. He also wrote the TV themes for The Man from U.N.C.L.E., Dr. Kildare, The Waltons, and Barnaby Jones. His 1976 score for The Omen won an Oscar. He received another 17 Academy Award nominations and 5 Emmy Awards. Terry spoke with Jerry Goldsmith in 2002. They opened with his score from Patton, the World War II movie starring George C. Scott as General George Patton.
People talk about Patton as a war film. I never viewed it as a war film. I viewed it as a personal documentary or biography of a man who was a warrior, yes, but there were two other aspects of him, which I did capture in the music. He was a very religious man, in spite of his profane personality, and he was also a total intellectual and a deep believer in reincarnation and history, and he spoke fluent French. He was cultured in musically. I mean, the dichotomy of the man, and you know how profane he was, but yet there was this depth of. So he was a complex personality, and I tried capturing these three levels of his personality in music by the fanfare, which has become sort of well known, is meant to represent the archaic part of him, the historical, the intellectual part of him. The chorale was to represent the religious aspect of him, and of course the military aspect, and it was designed contrapuntally so that all three could be played simultaneously or individually or two at a time, whatever.
Now, you've written the themes for several TV shows. Dr. Kildare, The Man from U.N.C.L.E., both of those are on your new CD.
The Waltons.
Why don't we hear the theme that you wrote for The Man from U.N.C.L.E.?
Okay.
Anything you want to say about it?
I guess during late 50s and 60s, we all had to be versatile, so we had to have jazz influence in our music, and so that was what I sort of tried to do. But to make it more interesting, I originally wrote it in 5/4, which, except for Dave Brubeck, was not really a meter that was particularly common in jazz. And an interesting side note of this whole thing is after the first season, they wanted to save money, and I had written it for a larger group. Like it was 20 players, and they wanted to cut it down to a little, like, 4 or 5 piece, because you had to pay each year to re-record the theme. So they wanted to save money, so I was unavailable, so they hired Lalo Schifrin, and Lalo did a very hip arrangement of it for a small group, and that's really what they used for the years of the, however long the show was on the air. It was Lalo's arrangement of the theme.
I want to talk about another theme that you wrote, and that's the theme for Chinatown, which I think is really just one of the great scores. Let's talk about the opening theme.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a specific part of the movie or a specific emotion within the movie that you wanted that opening theme to evoke or address?
The story was that the picture had been recorded before by scored by someone else before, and then they previewed it, and actually, the previews in the picture were evidently, from what I was told, were not very successful. And the music was not very good either. I must say that when I did see the picture, I had heard a little of the music, and it was Chinese. So it seemed rather inappropriate for the film. So anyway, so I was called in to do it, and I had to do the score in 10 days, which was a very short period of time to do it. And the producer, Robert Evans, had said to me, we should have a period feel in the music, period feel being the style of the 30s. And I said, well, you've got that in this Bunny Berrigan recording you're using. Is, you know, it's coming off the radio and all that. And you see that in the cinematography and the costumes, the wardrobe, and the whole feel, the look of the picture was 30s Los Angeles. And I grew up I was here as a young kid in the 30s. I know what it looked like and felt like, and that was the amazing thing about this picture. It was that feel was so true. I said, so musically, I want to try and go for the tragedy of the story. I finished recording it, and the movie came out like 3 days later, so we were really right down to the wire on it. So I didn't have a lot of time to think. I just had to sit down and write a theme for this movie and get on with it.
Film composer Jerry Goldsmith died on Wednesday at the age of 75. Our conversation with him was recorded in 2002.